Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Every game developer, and indeed gamer, knows a great tutorial is a key part of a game. They are essential to showing players the basics and expand the scope of a game by making it more accessible. The problem is that it can be tough to create a tutorial that pleases everyone. Here are 6 tips for designing a game tutorial. Those tips are less text. Don't front-load tutorials. It should be fun. Reinforce learning through play. Listen to players. And players should always have access to what is conveyed in the tutorials. Those are the words of Dylan Moran, I think, over at Game Career Guide. Moran. We'll go with Dylan Moran. I'm Danielle Rando, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 181. And joining me today in a beautiful discussion of game tutorials and elegant versus inelegant tutorials are Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
So this topic may sound a little dry, and I am using this sort of like semi, very like Game Career Guide is very much a how-to and tips and hands-on and blogs about sort of making games. But this really struck me this week because I'm playing a game called Bad North, which I think has a really elegant and really awesome tutorial. It's a relatively simple sort of real-time strategy game where you are sort of manipulating these very cute, very beautiful little 3D environments and sending little tiny bastions of troops around your island to defend it from the oncoming hordes. Little bad guys come in boats, and you have to basically just sort of send units to the right place at the right time. And the tutorial for it is really, really simple. It's just sort of like move around, look at the camera, and move your units here or move your units there. It's that simple. It's that easy. And then it just builds very elegantly, very, very simply from there. And I thought it was just a really great example of something that just sort of shows you how to do everything, shows you everything you need to know, but it doesn't overwhelm the player right away. And you're just sort of playing the game as it's going to be played, at least on a basic level, right away from, you know, sort of the first minute. There's not like hours of text or too many mechanics or you know, over tutorialization. It's just this very elegant, very simple, smooth process to get into it. So I thought maybe we could start by talking about games that we've been impressed by lately and how they've sort of onboarded us, if they've done so in a particularly nice or cool way. So Rob, I know you've been playing a lot of F1 2018 this week, and I have no idea if there's anything in the tutorial to that game, or if it's just aimed at such a hardcore audience that it's...
No, I mean, it's following a lot of what pretty much any racing... Like, the first racing games that started really introducing tutorial elements that I recall are the Simbin games. Like, I think Gran Turismo would have, like, license checks early in the series where you'd have to, like, prove that you can, like, shift the car really smoothly and stuff like that, which would teach you some aspects of racecraft, but like, you know, the Simbin games, which I talked about in an open thread a couple weeks ago, last week, as a matter of fact, had like the dynamic racing line. That's the first time I saw that, which shows you like, you know, where to hit the gas, where to hit the brake. And as you're approaching it live, it shows you like, oh, you're going too fast. Like the line turns red because you need to like brake and shed some speed. And I think that's where a lot of racing games have ended up with like teaching players tracks. F1 2018 mostly relies on that. And then, as we talked about like in the show earlier this week, they also have those different testing modes to teach you different ways of driving the track, which does, again, like, it hammers home racing techniques and applying it to each of the circuits to be racing at. I'm not sure it is as successful at, like, explaining the whys or hows of why this stuff matters, necessarily. Like, what's the way to put this? There's a lot of subsystems that we're messing with in F1 2018. You'll do the tests that, like, make you mess with those subsystems, like adjust your energy recovery settings. But they won't actually have, like, a tutorial where they, like, sort of take you by the hand and, like, okay, now in this stage of the racing lap, here's how you get into your multifunction display and change your car settings. You just kind of have to, like, do that live and, like, notice the button prompt. So it's an interesting case of, like, it does a great job of teaching, I think, the second order knowledge of playing the game, where you like you understand the basic mechanics and like how to control everything. But as far as I can tell, it kind of like completely like skips that first step of like, okay, here's your car and here's what it does. It doesn't do that. Maybe for that audience, like, you don't need that stuff. It's like the equivalent of in an RTS where you have that obligatory tutorial level where it's like, now select that soldier, so, you know, and you do it and it's like, great job. You know, maybe the reason to skip that sort of stuff. But yeah, F1 2018 definitely like starts with an assumed knowledge level, teaches you how to use the resources based on that level, but won't actually help you get up there.
That's an interesting choice. Patrick, I know you've been playing a lot of Dead Cells, and I'm curious to hear how that sort of onboards the player. That, and also, of course, being someone who plays a lot of really difficult platformers and really difficult games in general, how you kind of feel about a tutorial? Like, what do you want in a tutorial? What is a successful tutorial for you?
Well, I'm not sure tutorials are necessarily aimed at me, like that kind of person. Tutorials are, you know, it depends on what they're there for. They're there to help someone that is familiar with the genre understand, okay, we don't need to tell you how to do X, Y, and Z. We just need to tell you what this game does differently. And then even layered into that, there's, you know, as Rob alluded to, there are games that essentially want you to find and discover by trying. And that's built into the game. It's not the game ignoring that in the tutorial. It's the game saying, actually, it's far more useful for you to figure that out through failure or experimentation or organically, as opposed to a tutorial prompt saying, like, hey, you should do this because it does that. Because often you're less likely to sort of ingrain that information and process that information if it's being told to you as opposed to the act of doing. And so, you know, Dead Cells doesn't explain a whole lot to you. It explains its basic mechanics. I don't think it explains its, you know, its buttons. I think Dead Cells basically starts with, you are in a room, you walk to the next room, there's a sword you can pick up, there's a shield you can pick up, and then you're just meant to figure it out from there. I don't think it tells you how to jump, how to attack, how to use your items. It doesn't tell you that there's a ground pound, which is something that I've discovered sort of organically by accident by just holding down down an A. If that game trusts you to sort of, if you're the kind of person that picked this up, fucking this isn't your first rodeo, and we're not going to pretend it is. And for a lot of people, I think the discovery process is, you want that. You want the game to sort of embrace the fact that you have a built-in knowledge set. That said, you know, I mean, it's I think, very helpful for games to remember that not everyone playing a game has played a game before. That said, I'm sure it's a challenge for developers to figure out what is the fine line between that, because not every game is going to have a tutorial that explains, here's how you play a video game, and yet you want to make sure that people come away with enough knowledge that they aren't frustrated while they're playing the game. There's this game, what is it called, that I was playing yesterday called The King's Bird, which is this really beautiful platformer. It's a really challenging, really one of the most difficult platformers I've played in a long time. And it technically explained how it's a very physics-based platformer in which you're doing a lot of tinkering with momentum and bouncing off walls and like chaining things like that together in order to accomplish really difficult platforming tasks. And I finished the tutorial, and I followed what it told me to do, and I made it through the challenges that it put in front of me that were next to the button prompts that explained X does Y. The moment it dropped me into a real level, it was became very clear that I actually did not actually process any of those lessons, and found myself swearing loudly with a door open down here into the just just screaming obscenities because I could not understand for the life of me why the fuck I could not get up the wall and scale onto the next thing, because it didn't look that difficult, but clearly it looked easy, but I could not do it. And I was like, I play a lot of these games. This seems like a failure of the game. And the game didn't fail. The game explained it just... It took me like 20 minutes of fucking around to realize, like, I was just holding a button in a slightly wrong way. The game wasn't giving me the kind of feedback for me to figure that out. But once I'd put it together, I was stringing together exactly what the game wanted me to do. And so, you know, that's an instance where it's hard to tell, was it me, the player, not quite putting together or processing the tutorial? Was it that the tutorial should have been longer and more pronounced and more specific and repetitive in making sure that you picked up on the idiosyncrasies of this particular platformer? Like, you know, I mean, I'm sure you do playtesting and then, you know, you fall on different things. Also, from what I understand about game development, tutorials are done basically last. That's not something that is done it's day one of production on this new game. Let's start thinking about the tutorial. Like, that is, you know, one of the bottom of the list things that is done. And so I think that also helps explain why a lot of tutorials are bad, is because they are done towards the end of the development process. And also they're being created by people who know the game very well. And that's going to make it a challenge to communicate when you already have a sort of ingrained set of knowledge.
Yeah. Rob, it sounds like you had something there.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things here that I don't know how I want these problems solved, because on the one hand, I'm thinking about two really different cases, but they're just rattling around in my head right now. Every time I decide, like, you know, I think I'm ready to play Valkyria Chronicles again. The thing that discourages me is like, oh, remember, like the first 3 hours of that game are basically an extended tutorial. It's
That's very Japanese.
Welcome. Here's how you move your fucking tank. And I'm like, yeah, I remember. I played this game. And it's like, no, we're gonna go through it. Like, very slow, like, layering in of new concepts. Like, Phantom Doctrine, which, you know, I just reviewed. I would argue is mostly tutorial. Like, it slowly, like, introduces stuff at a glacial pace, so that, like, there's major systems that you won't encounter for hours and hours. And so that stuff, like, becomes a real hurdle, because you kind of want to get to the good stuff, right? Just like, no, let me get to the part where, like, most of the tools are at my disposal and I can run with that. But if you take that stuff out of the main campaign and make it, like, part of an optional tutorial, you kind of mess with the entire flow of the game, right? You don't have that like organic place to go learn the game the first time you play it, which will help keep it interesting, as this guide suggests, right? Like, the reason the Valkyria Chronicles tutorial works at all is because, rather than taking you out to basically the equivalent of like a tactical parking lot where you go like learn, you know, like early driving lessons, like, okay, now park between the lines. Like, that's just boring to do in a game. You don't want to do it. So they fold it into the campaign, and the first time that works great. But every time you play the game after that, it's like, fuck, I do not want to go through this shit again. I'm just done. But then the other example rattling around my head, I guess it's related to F1 2018, is I think sports games have this huge problem of, like,
yeah,
there's knowing how to, like, press the buttons and make shit happen in a sports game. And then there's actually, like, understanding the actual game concepts and applying those controls. Like, dude, when I played NHL 17, it was sort of the first time I played the game in a few years. I had to spend like 5-6 hours going back through those tutorials to be like, okay, so what, like, how do I deke again? Like, what, like, I have to learn to do all this shit. When I go back and go to Madden, it's like, I can call plays and run them, but to actually, like, really play Madden, like, you got to know how to, like, call your hot routes.
Well, yeah, there's, like, playing, and then there's playing. Like, yeah. You can know how to. Oh, I gotta hit the A button so I can, or the X button so I can throw it at the player. But that doesn't tell you strategy. And, like, actually, I think that's probably what a lot of games fail to do. Is it's one thing to explain technically how the game works. It's quite another to, like, play it with any level of sophistication. And Madden is, like, sports games in general, like, are really great examples of that, where you can do the tutorial, come out of it, and go, fucking, I still don't know how to play this game.
Well, and even, or yeah. maybe they'll even teach you some of these concepts, but then you start playing the game and you're like, I don't feel confident in these skills that I was just taught, so I'm going to stick to the basics, and I'm not going to, like, the last time I tried to use a hot route, like, I ended up calling an audible, and then I punted. I don't know what happened.
I'm just going to throw a Hail Mary, because I know what happens. The guys run real far, and then I throw the ball.
Yeah, exactly. But then you're like, whatever you picked up from the tutorial and learning those systems, that begins to atrophy too. And so then you have this sort of reinforcing cycle of people not pushing the boundaries of their understanding of the game, because outside of the initial tutorial stuff, when you're actually playing it like for real and it counts, I think there's a tendency for games to encourage a conservative play that discourages experimentation and therefore learning.
Yeah, this is all not to also talk about fighting again, but this is also certainly bringing things up about competing and doing grappling. We'll literally drill moves, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And sometimes my coach will like take your leg and put it in the right place. Just it's the same thing as like, oh, I know that the X button will do this kind of thing. But once you're actually sparring or competing, it's just sort of like, I'm going to do this thing because this thing felt right. You know, kind of going back to either basics or something that you actually did sort of digest properly in your brain and actually understand and actually, you know, feels right to do. But there's always the question of challenging yourself to, you know, learn the other 800,000 things there are to learn in something like a deep game, like a Madden or any sports game, really. But especially Madden. I haven't played a Madden game since 2003, maybe 2002. So it's been a long
even
time.
Even by then, they'd started to get really aggressive with like the like offensive management stuff. Like I remember, oh man, it was brutal. I think it was like NCAA 2002. I was controlling the Purdue Boilermakers, Northwest Indiana kid. I was going to be Purdue. And I was really into the game. And I was like, I'm pretty good. Like I'm playing on like an advanced difficulty level. Like I'm winning games. Like, you know, Boilermakers become a great team under my watch. I think I'm good at NCAA basically. And my buddy comes over, who was like super into these games, and he's like, "All right, you think you're good at this game? Okay, let's see. Who's next?" So we like, "Oh, don't never do this. Don't ever do this." I was playing. I loaded my main campaign save. My next game was against IU. Hated IU. My buddy loved IU.
Oh no!
And so he's like, "Well, I'll just play against you." I had a perfect record. Mind you, the thing about college football is basically you need a perfect record, especially back then. You needed a perfect record if you're going to like do anything in the postseason. So I'm like, all right, yeah. It's like IU had a shitty football program in that era. Never had a great football program, but it was really bad back then. But they had this one guy who eventually I think played for the Steelers, Randall L. You remember Randall L, Patrick?
Vague, like it's scratching something at the back of my head.
Yeah, like one of the prototypical, like super athletic, rangy quarterbacks, like a Michael Vick archetype, like run the wildcat, basically type offense, option offense, very very heavy stuff like that. And so my buddy like takes over IU and like puts Randall L in at quarterback, and I'm just doing the thing where like playing NCAA and I'm like, I'm going to call my defense, call my offense. Like, here's my play. And my buddy's just like fucking reading me. Like like the teams are coming to the line and he just looks at the way I've lined up. And like, then some of these like flurry emotions, you know, on the controller and like the defense and offense, like completely realigns. And then he just like fucking burned me play after play after play after play. Like, I think I lost by like 100 to like 14 or so. It was brutal and like just completely trashed my save. It was like one of those edge cases where even the canned commentary is starting to comment like how weird this is. Where they're like, man, didn't think Purdue would get destroyed by this team so badly. Like, it was shit like that.
Do we have to stick around and keep commentating?
Yeah. It was.
I'm getting a beer. Yeah.
But the thing is, like, he had all this ability to use those advanced game concepts and had practiced with them a ton. Nothing in the game ever really suggested to me that it was necessary. Like, if you have a busted play, you have a busted play.
Right.
But there was nothing in the game that said, like, hey, you might want to move your tight end over here and have them run a different route. And here's how you do that. Like, I needed offensive coordinator Clippy, basically, to be like, hey, it looks like you're running a post route. Would you like to, do something like that? But a lot of games, I think, struggle to teach those second order, like, both understanding game concepts and applying your tools to those concepts. I think a lot of games, especially ones that are like kind of complicated, really struggle with that stuff.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I also think teaching style is a major issue here as well. So, you know, you have your Dark Souls style brutal teacher, you know, who the master on the mountain kind of thing, where, you know, the young swordsman comes up and wants to learn from the master and, like, you know, chops wood for a year before you're really, like,
but the game still has a tutorial, though. Like, but it's interesting how they have changed over time. So, like, for example, in Dark Souls, you enter into this sort of, like, really small contained area that has, like, a tiny little bit of everything, flavor of the game. And there are little, the messages you find in the game, which are usually written by players, are messages from the developers explaining, you know, how to attack, how to dodge, how to run, how to roll. And then you get picked up by a giant crow, and then the game transports you to the main game. Like, you fight a bunch of enemies, you probably die there, there's a bonfire, there's an enemy. Like, the loop of Dark Souls is, like, contained within, like, this extremely tiny little spot, in which there's a lot of implicit tutorializing going on through the reactions to the player, and then explicit tutorializing going on that is, like, hey, yo, to roll, you hit circle. Whereas I believe in Bloodborne, there is none of that. You're just kind of thrown into the game. So the way that, like, Bloodborne opens is that I believe it's been a long time since I played the opening, but they give you a couple of the basics, but then, whereas in Dark Souls, this area you're meant to die, or you're meant to defeat the boss and then proceed to the next area. In Bloodborne, the first major enemy encounter, you're expected to die. Like, you can beat it. There are, like, videos of people beating that first enemy and progressing. Like, the game does not, like, allows you to continue if you manage to pull it off, but you are not meant to beat that enemy. And then you die, and then you go to this in-between world, the Hunter's Dream, for people who played the game, and then that's where you get some more tutorialization, some context, some setup. Like, those are two very different ways to sort of, like, jump between the various, like, I guess it's like, you know, as you know, we've been talking about, like, the difference between implicit and explicit tutorializing, where there are ways for games to be very forward, and then there are ways for games to kind of guide you along a path without saying that that's what they're actually doing.
But Danielle, like, you're talking about fighting, reminds me of one of the really tricky things to teach players, especially if you don't want to just piss them off, is, like, how do you prepare people for those high stakes, systematically complicated or systemically complicated encounters? Like, again, we talked about this the other day. Like, point of reference is fencing. Like, when things get very fast paced and very close in, it is moving faster than you really can process sometimes. Like, things are happening and, like, muscle memory is firing, but, like, I couldn't actually say what the move counter move actually was. I don't really know. I just sort of had to feel my way through. A lot of games do want you to know that stuff. And, like, PUBG is an example of, like, it doesn't explicitly guide you to this, but, like, doing the spicy drop is a good way to learn core elements of the game, because, like, you just go in there, you start messing around with weapons, you fight people, it's all high stakes, you cut right to the really high-pressure part and the really failure-prone part, and that's where you learn it. You don't try to hide from it, and that's one of the ways you get good. I think a lot of games have a hard time bringing that moment to players, and so players are never quite prepared for it, and that can be really frustrating. I feel like sometimes I see that frustration happening on the Bloodborne streams with Natalie, where it's like,
Yeah, the sink or swim parts are brutal in that game especially, but in a lot of games, because obviously this stuff is hard and people learn it different. speeds and they learn better from different things. That's why, you know, the one size fits all option is never going to be the best option, because some people actually do a lot better with like gentle tutorialization and handholding. And some people do a lot better if they're thrown into something and they want to figure things out on their own. There's different types of players or different things that motivate players, right? Of course. And it sure is interesting to watch, especially with Bloodborne. There is one concept I want to talk about a little bit here, and that is with like a traditional, you know, games that have level structures, right? More or less traditional level structures. Bloodborne, I think, uses its sort of entire first level as something of a tutorial, because there is, again, there's no like explicit tutorial in that game. Yeah, that first room you wake up in, or I guess it's the second room that you go in, has a werewolf in it, and you're just like a scrub and you're sweat. I think it's sweaty clothes that you start off in. Oh, I guess it depends on what your build is, but you've got nothing really. You can punch a werewolf if you want, and like it's sink or swim. But that whole level is very, it starts off in a pretty linear way, right? It's like there are alleyways and corridors, and you can actually very explicitly see, you know, you go down that sort of first little alleyway and there's a guy sleeping, and then he gets up, but it's only sort of one enemy at that point. And then there's, I think, two more, and then you're actually at that sort of first street where there's a roving band of enemies, and that's explicitly supposed to teach you how to pull enemies, right? A lot of these things are sort of woven into that first level, and that's pretty typical in a lot of games, right? That things that are sort of woven into a first level or sort of hinted at or given, you know, you're given some information about a particular mechanic or some information about a particular operation in order to kind of get a sense of it and whet your appetite, I guess, for it, and see if this is really going to be something you want to stick with or if it's something you're going to, you know, fall out of. And that's always a danger. Rob, it looks like you've got something there.
No.
Oh, sorry. I thought there was a gesture. One thing I did want to talk about, and we kind of touched a tiny bit on just generally Japanese games, but I wanted to talk about Nintendo games in this, because I think Nintendo both has some great tutorialization in some of its games and horrible tutorialization in other games, specifically the sort of latter Zelda games. Not Breath of the Wild. I think Breath of the Wild is an excellent example. But Skyward Sword was the 2012 Zelda game, the precursor in a lot of ways to Breath of the Wild. Was dinged absolutely rightly for having this, God, oh, it took hours to feel like you were getting anywhere in that game. And Twilight Princess, the game before that as well. And both of them were burdened with, I think it's correct to say, burdened with motion controls and other ways of controlling the game, other ways of operating the game that got in the way, certainly for me and for, you know, some other folks. And that could be an issue. But things like the Mario games, like even the very early Mario games, have amazing tutorialization. That first level in the first Super Mario Brothers, you're sort of taught right away what a good mushroom and a bad mushroom is, right? There's like, oh, the power-up, that does a good thing. I'm bigger now. I'm more powerful. Immediately kind of tells you something, whereas there's an angry little mushroom running around and you run into that and you die, right? Just immediately you're brought up. All these concepts are kind of brought up in a subtle way, implicit in both the level design and sort of the enemy design and power-up design. So I'm curious if either of you have some sort of Nintendo thoughts, because yeah, it feels like they've run the gamut in a way that is extreme on both ends for me.
Well, I mean, I think the Skyward Sword was an extreme example of a game that has what Rob mentioned earlier of, more of a tendency amongst Japanese video games to like have these really protracted tutorials that are spread out in the real game itself, in which if it was just condensed into something much smaller, it would be more effective. And I think Nintendo is a company that tries to appeal to all audiences and specifically younger audiences. I think sometimes they find themselves in a situation where the handholding comes from a position of wanting to make sure that people are grasping the game that they're making. And in the case of Skyward Sword was like, they just did that for far too long at the expense of the momentum in the game and the pacing of the game for people who, you know, didn't need that much time. It would seem like, and at some point it becomes patronizing to the point of, you know, you should just trust the player. And so a lot of this tutorialization comes down to like, how much do games trust the player, or not trust the player. And in the case of Nintendo games, often it's that they do not trust players because they they trust them, but they want to be very clear about their intentions. And like the tutorial is one way that Nintendo communicates that.
Yeah. And on the other hand, you have something like WarioWare, where it's like, just play it.
Right.
And a lot of the design is just sort of communicated immediately in those little sort of 4-second games. So yeah, it's very... Right. It's very interesting to me how they approach different genres, certainly. And something like Splatoon felt like a good balance, at least to me, in terms of explaining stuff, but without being overly hand-holdy.
I think it's them trusting, like, hey, we're making a shooter. And
yeah.
So, you know,
you know how this works.
Things. Well, and I think also something yeah. that's changed in the culture these days, and I'm not sure how much this is applicable to Nintendo specifically or just sort of holistically for the industry, is that... Well, look, if you want something explained, like, there are people on YouTube and Twitch that will do it for you, you know? If you want to know how to do X, how to find Y, well, you know, why not err on the side of not explaining it? And then if you need to go find that, there's a whole community that will both profit off of and do it for you. I think a lot of developers, you know, either on purpose or... like, just sort of accidentally stumble into relying on communities built up around their games in order to sort of satisfy certain expectations of the player, certain questions by the player that could be answered by the community itself.
Yeah, that's a very good point, certainly.
That and there itself, is a question. Sorry, oh, I was just going to say, that in itself, though, becomes a, like, kind of an examination. Like, it's an exam of, are you good at finding where those good tutorials are? Because it's not always like a thing you can just search and like wisdom of the crowd will guide you to.
No,
like,
it's here's a 45-minute video with 17 minutes of setup and like 8 minutes of make sure to like subscribe and comment. And then like, oh, how do I find the 45 fucking seconds that I need in order to do the task? The downfall of video.
Yeah.
It's a trip.
Especially again, if you're talking about like stuff that's more unpacking like more advanced concepts, right? Like who's actually going to explain this in a way that's helpful and also right. not in a way that's like somehow wrong, right? Like you can have like good tutorials yeah. that like contain some bad information in them, and like if you accept that as like, well, this is the right way to do it, that can send you down a dark path. So that becomes tricky in itself. But yeah, I Nintendo's something I can't speak too much too, because I'm not like much of a Nintendo gamer, and have,
even though you got that Switch,
that's true, but like I don't have the background with Nintendo sure. games, not since the SNES games. I think the genius of a lot of Nintendo games is you just never know that you're being taught and instructed. Like as a kid, like you're thinking, and this was me playing Nintendo games, I'm like, man, I'm good at this shit, and it didn't dawn on me that like, no man, like you were kind of taught everything in this level about how it worked in the first, like, you know, minute and a half, and then you just had to repeat.
Yeah. This isn't an intrinsic skill.
Yeah.
But it does make you feel special, right? That's something I've always found very interesting about games in particular, and tutorialization is just how smart it makes you feel when it's done well. And Portal's, of course, the, like, gold standard in this, but just something that makes you feel so damn smart. Because it's been designed to teach you at a really good and really sort of pleasurable pace. And you start mastering things and you're like, wow, look at me. I'm a pro gamer. Look at me doing all these puzzles or doing all this amazing stuff and having all these incredible skills. It's very appealing. I wanted to give one quick example, an old example for having the wrong information in a tutorial. I remember Mario 64, the Prima official guide to Super Mario 64, maybe it was unofficial, I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was Prima, though. Had the wrong way, definitely the wrong way, to get the star in the pyramid in the desert world that had to do with, like, the hands. There's, like, weird, like, they're not mummy hands. They're, like, brick hands. It's fine. It's okay if you don't recall this. But it had some weird, arcane, like, series of jumps instead of just, like, going and facing this one enemy in, like, this really easy and simple way. And it was clearly, like, whoever wrote this guide, like, was up all night devising, like, this beautiful strategy, this, like, incredible, probably, like, speedrunner strat, and ended up being like, no, there is another way to do this. The intended path was completely different, and I always found that, like, very amusing, even though I was, like, 13 and reading this guide, like, I don't think that's right. I don't think you need to do that. I felt very smart. There is one more question I wanted to ask before we go into our letters, and that is, it's a little bit of a slight segue, but it has to do with, I think about this a lot, right? in terms of how essential is a good tutorial to actual world building and story and setting and actually like setting tone and mood as well as teaching gameplay concepts, right? I think we've all played games that are like perfectly good games that were enjoyable and fun to play, but like the tutorial felt very much like, and now we're sitting in a classroom and learning a thing, and then we'll go to the real game, as opposed to something that felt very organic to the process of the game itself, or actually put you in a certain headspace or something. I think Bloodborne is actually a pretty good example of that, even though I think Bloodborne has some issues. We've talked about it a little bit, but in using its sort of first level as a giant tutorial, as like a big tutorial space that also has other elements, and you can certainly go and explore and you can do other things, but going through on the sort of intended path really does teach you all the various mechanics you're going to need for most of the rest of the game. And it does it organically, and it does it in this creepy, weird, very, very intense world. And also does, of course, that wonderful bait and switch with the Victorian Ed Hardy aesthetics there. So that's also pretty cool. But do either of you have examples of that where it's been done really well or really poorly, I suppose, as well?
I think a lot of tutorials can, like, a tutorial is a great place to explain what is this game even about? Like, fundamentally, sure. What is the thing it's trying to evoke, the thing it is trying to sort of get out of you, the competence it's trying to develop in you? Like, F1 does a good job of this, the testing sessions, but, like, a lot of games do, like, can have really elegant sort of hidden tutorials by leaning on atmosphere and narrative or thematic justifications, right? Like, game I'm thinking about just kind of randomly right now is the Brothers in Arms series by Gearbox, which was a really cool, like, World War II first-person shooter, but like sort of a squad command mechanic. Well, the first game opens, I think, on, like, D-Day, right? So it's that you know, the guys jumping out of the planes, landing, you know, behind enemy lines. And it's all really dramatic because, you know, D-Day, night paratroop, you know, airborne drop, it's all very exciting. But the justification is, like, hey, we've caught the Germans by surprise. Like, so it's not going to be too hard. It's going to be dramatic, but here's what you do. And it's very linear. It's more linear than the game is going to be at any point after. But it's like, okay, here's a clear piece of cover that flanks an enemy position. Tell your guys to go there. See what happens. And, like, it gives you that sort of baby steps thing. And it doesn't really let up on that until you sort of hit a climactic, like, bayonet charge, I think, at the end of sort of this extended, like, first level sequence. But that's very effective at telling you, like, here's what your character's supposed to be doing. This is not actually just a game where you run around and, like, shoot the Nazis. Like, it's actually more important that you use the squads that you've got around you and, like, use the way the level is laid out. That's how you're going to play this game. And it never feels sort of like a drag because it's got that sort of cool, like, wrapper around it.
Yeah.
So I think that sort of stuff tends to work really well. But again, it's a tricky thing to pull off because what's the difference between that and Valkyria Chronicles? Like, why is Brothers in Arms, like, kind of a good on-ramp into the game? And Valkyria Chronicles, literally, I stop myself from replaying the game because I start thinking about the first 3 hours.
Oh, God. Yeah, definitely.
I can't think of anything specific in that direction, but I know that, like, as a general rule, I appreciate, or I find it fun when a game sort of, like, deliberately chooses to not have a tutorial, and then, you know, it's sort of on you as the player to sort of, like, poke and prod and figure out what exactly are the rules of this game, what are the limits of this game, and the reason it doesn't have tutorials because it wants you to do that on your explicitly on your own is to find those boundaries and to press the buttons on the controller and to press the buttons on the keyboard to figure out exactly what you're going to be allowed to do. And so it's always fun where, you know, that game sort of requires, you know, that the person playing it is, you know, knows what they're in for, but it's always fun when the game sort of trusts you with that long of a leash to just say, hey, you know, go figure it out, have fun.
Yeah, that is a lot of fun. I always love that, especially in kind of experimental games or weird games, or something like Paratopic has been on my mind again lately as something that just is operating in on a weird level and you don't completely understand it till you've been playing it for a little while. And it's just like, yeah. There is a sort of element of mystery, right, that you want to preserve, at least in certain types of games. If the player experience is to kind of have that mystery or kind of have that sort of layer of obfuscation, and that's actually part of what you're dealing with, and it's pretty necessary to not be like, well, and then you're going to walk here and there's going to be a hard cut, and then you're going to walk here and there's going to be another cut. That would ruin the whole thing, right? So, yeah. If there are no other thoughts on tutorials, I suppose we should take a quick break. And we'll be right back with some reader mail.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And we're back. It's not reader mail. I forgot. It's the question bucket. How dare I use the wrong term for for this beautiful correspondence that we have.
This guy's got a couple of readers. I don't know why they called it reader mail. It's all bullshit.
I know. It's such bullshit. It's a very old-timey term. Like, it does make me think of, like, and here's the mailman.
On the other hand, we did try to one-up them with weekend correspondence. So, you know, yeah, we're true. Assholes, too.
It's anyway, like all our fault. That it's bucket, all our fault, Rob.
The trough.
I'm dipping in! Dip it in. There's a bucket. I'm going right in. I've got a good question here. I'm reeling it up. I'm miming a terrible fishing rod. This is from Josh. And Josh writes, "Hey, Waypoint crew. One of my favorite genres of games has always been JRPGs. But I had to watch a lot of cool series disappear over the years. Personal favorites of mine like Suikoden, oh god. Something like that. And Skies of Arcadia either stopped getting sequels or never got one at all. Side note, I was so glad Fire Emblem became popular instead of dying with Awakening. Have you all had favorite series or games vanish, and how have you dealt with it? Best, Josh." Well, I sure loved GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, and that one didn't end super hot. That one, there was Perfect Dark Zero, it was like an Xbox 360, I think, launch game, or maybe original Xbox launch game. And
Perfect Dark Zero?
Yeah, that was original Xbox?
That was 360.
It was 360. Okay, yeah, it was like 2005. Okay. And that just, it wasn't super awesome. Just wasn't the most awesome game. And so, I mean, honestly, this is me with everything Rare, right? This is Banjo-Kazooie, this is the, you know, Perfect Dark and GoldenEye series. It's a lot of those Rare games that I loved and grew up with and adored and wanted to see in the new generation, wanted to see with new quirks, wanted to see with new design paradigms, and then it just kind of didn't happen. Although I will hold out hope forever that one day there will be another Banjo-Kazooie that's actually good. So it's my biggest one, probably.
Wow, there's so many games these days. Like, pretty much, I mean, I'm hard-pressed to, like, that there's a specific type of game that they just don't make anymore, because, I mean, that's just... The problem is they make too, like, you know, August had too many Metroidvania-style games, to the point where Guacamelee 2, a game that seems totally fine and good, it was like, okay, I already played three of these in the last month. I don't... Please stop, actually.
Well, I guess it's all good in basic land, Patrick. But wow. Let me tell you about...
There's no more immersive Sims.
Yeah, exactly.
Throw the table. You know,
you fucking got Prey and Dishonored, like a massive DLC.
But now they've been sent off to a farm in Connecticut.
Oh, shut the fuck up! You got the last 18 months, like at least
Daniel's
point
the last
was like
years.
A game.
Yeah,
at least Daniel's point was that they're not gonna make. But I don't think you'd want to play a new Perfect Dark that was made that was floaty as hell. Like,
no, I want another good version of.
You want like
of...
Splinter Cell with Joanna Dark is what you want.
Yeah, basically. Or even, like, well, I know Time Splitters just got acquired, so maybe something cool could happen. But I like that, like, very fun, almost cartoonish shooters that have, like, mission-based gameplay instead of just combat. Like, that that's what appealed to me. I mean, the new Doom actually touched on some of that, certainly, but I'm not just in it for shooting ever with like almost any game. I really enjoyed the level design in a lot of those in like the Golden Age and Perfect Dark games. I thought it was pretty wild and like I actually had fun exploring off the beaten path and things like that. So I'm also weird, which is fine. Sorry, Rob. It looks like you've got
I'm constantly pining over shit I'm not going to get more of, right? Like, I mean, this is why I wrote a big thing about, like, oh man, like, somebody's, like, saying they're going to make Stalker 2 again for, like, what, 2023 or something like that? Like, and,
yeah, and then, like, 2 weeks later it's revealed, like, oh, we only announced that to hopefully get funding from somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, I'm always like, well, maybe. That'd be cool. And there's a point where you just, like, kind of have to, like, let something rest, where it's like, well, we had, like, that's what that was. And it's almost better that you have, like, the Stalker series, which is good, and is sort of complete, and it exists, and it hasn't become, like, a husk of itself the way some weird, like, I was weirdly into the Fear series, basically on the strength of one being such a great fucking shooter. But each new Fear game was worse than the last. Like, there were some things I liked in 3, but, like, it was kind of dog shit, too. Like, the story was completely all over the map, and no longer...
Did Monolith even make the third one?
They made the third one. They didn't make the second one. And the third one...
Oh, I flipped those in my head.
Yeah, and the third one kind of pretended the second one never happened, I think.
Right.
Oh, one of those.
It's a very weird thing. The chronology is very strange. Like, the first game gets 2 expansions that were made by Not Monolith. And then the second game is also made by Not Monolith. And then Monolith comes back, I think, for the third game and says, no, none of that happened. And they erase everything that came before. But in retrospect, it probably would have been better if, like, there'd been no more Fear after the first one. And, like, you just had this one good game. And, like, you know, a No One Lives Forever situation. There is no bad No One Lives Forever game. But I don't know. I'd rather that's a better situation for me than like Far Cry 2 eventually giving way to like Far Cry fucking 5.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's the counterpoint here to Josh's question. Like, either die young or live long enough to see your heroes, whatever. I don't remember what that phrase is.
Nailed it.
Sorry.
Don't ask that out. You gotta live with that one. Go own that.
So proud. It died like as I was saying it. I just
did a poor job of the yada 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 part where like you're like, oh, you know the phrase.
You know like
you
phrase
tried
about...
you tried to pick up the phrase again halfway through and then all
Here at Waypoint Radio, we get everything right the first time. Always. It's very beautiful.
We believe in growth here at Waypoint Radio. People can change.
That's right.
I believe you can change too. You can look up that phrase, Danielle, and you can get it right the second time.
You know, I could. I definitely could, but I'm afraid of making too much noise with this mouse. And that's why I'm just kind of like sitting here like, yeah, no, this is good. We did good today. I have a slightly heavier question here for the second one. Rob, it looks like you're already in here and you're taking a look.
No, I was looking up.
All right. So this one is about fascist aesthetics. I'm going to just do a verbal content warning right here. It's going to be about Nazis, fascist stuff, and both sides-ism. So get ready for that. This is from Lore. And Lore writes, I wanted to bring up video games' use of fascist aesthetics, and more specifically the ways World War II is used as a setting for so many competitive games that require a large degree of both sides-ing the conflict and meaning of that conflict to make work. HOI... I'm not sure what HOI is, but HOI 4 is more specifically what I had in mind, but the innumerable World War II themed FPS games come to mind. To me, these games have always felt integral to the sort of scare quotes, ironic Nazi jokes, the casual anti-Semitism and desensitization of this issue at best lead people to view this era and these subjects as, quote, not that bad, echoing, for instance, the lost cause view of the Confederate South, and at worst, to outright anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, and fascist fanboying that is rampant in the Gamergate alt-right circles. I know these groups also tend to sweep the evils of fascism, racism, and sexism, etc., under the rug throughout both sides' view of history through whataboutism and equivocating that I feel is supported by a game who only distinguishes between the two sides of this conflict through the color of the uniforms or X more hit points on German tanks. Am I perhaps making too big a deal of this? Or should we be asking why we're choosing to make World War II a rather equal or both sides conflict in video games? Should games media be, maybe be more critical of the use of fascist imagery and aesthetics in video games? Any thoughts appreciated? From Lore. So it's a nice heavy one.
Is that Hearts of Iron 4? Does that sound,
yes,
that could be a thing?
Yes, that sounds correct.
That's what my brain tried to play.
I think you're right.
Strategy game though, right?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm not that familiar with the series, obviously, but I do know that very recently, in the last week or so, actually, Gamasutra had a piece from a German studio that actually made the first game that was sort of allowed to use swastikas and other sort of Nazi imagery in their game. And they took a very, as I understood it in the piece that I read, and I can link that piece in the show notes, a very, very, very hard stance, obviously, against Nazism and the right and the Reich, the whole deal, which was very interesting because there is like a very, very, very strict rules there about what media can use certain symbols, obviously, because of the history there. So
through the dark,
that seems
the
like an
time,
interesting counterpoint. Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Yeah. There's a piece by the developers there who go into the whole process that they had to deal with the German government to actually, you know, convince them that they're making an artistic statement, they're making an actual statement against Nazism, using these symbols and using them in such a way to obviously denounce what they were using. It wasn't a piece of propaganda, basically, which was pretty wild. Are you familiar with the Hearts of Iron series, Rob?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've played Hearts of Iron 4 a lot. I like it a lot. It does not focus too much on the internal politics of the respective countries involved, which does kind of like Hearts of Iron 4 does present a world where you can sort of just tune out the reality of it and say, the world's a chessboard. Here's the state of play in 1933, and let's see who can, who can win the 1936. The world's a chessboard, and like, let's see who can, you know, play their side the best. And I don't know, like, to a degree, the question is a little bit loaded. Like, should we be more critical and thoughtful about like fascist imagery and aesthetics in video games touching on these historical topics? You'd have to be some kind of asshole to say, nah, I think we're good. Like, I think this just can be handled pretty neutrally and can just be kind of a cool thing that we play around with. Of course, you should.
I mean, he's kind of saying like, should every game that like invokes it also come with the caveat of like making sure the game is saying like, oh, by the way, this is bad. Which I don't feel that is necessarily the case. I mean, if he's implying that like through like the video games and media in general, like looking for the easy out, which is a good guy and a bad guy in a realistic setting, and then subsequently a war setting, like Nazis make it easy because it's black and white in a lot of ways. Like there were good people and there were bad people. Go shoot the bad people. Like that's easy enough. I think the reason that like people responded like really sharply to a game like the in the Wolfenstein reboot was like, yeah, okay, does it handle the Holocaust like really subtly and interestingly? No. But was it like shocking to have a game set in World War II that actually acknowledged like the Holocaust? Like, yes, because that's just not a thing that World War II video games, especially first person shooters, like ever engage with. And like the Holocaust is like that game, at least on some level, grappling with the ideology of Nazis rather than just, oh, they're bad, go shoot them, get to the end of the level. And so it's true that more games like just use the black and white nature of like them bad, go shoot, as opposed to like, well, maybe unpack that a little and find out a little bit what's beneath the surface of just, you know, a logo. But like the fact that there's like a strategy game that just lets you play out the elements of power and see who wins, who loses. Like, I don't know that Hearts of Iron needs to like tell you that Nazism is bad.
But isn't there something there to any game that lets you take on that role? Like, isn't there something, I don't know, I'm just sort of armchair, looking at this, thinking,
I mean, the Germans could have won, like, right? Like, I don't think it's like, implausible for a game to, like, set up, like, like, see how you could have tipped the balance of power and made different decisions. Like, I don't, letting you envision a scenario where, like, the Germans win, like, it doesn't reflect on the player in my mind that, like, you're bad because you saw a scenario where the Germans didn't fuck this up or the Allies didn't find a way through. So, I mean, I think it's a, you know, a fine line sometimes, and certainly the existence of this media can then be used by people to indulge in fantasies that are... Sure. Extreme, but I don't know that their mere existence is itself a problem.
I remember talking to Thomas Johansson about this over at Paradox, and he felt like it's an unresolved tension, because if you make games like this, you're not going to be able to resolve it. But he felt there was kind of an inherent allure to playing as the Germans in World War II, even if you are a diehard, like, committed, like, anti-fascist. Like, the allure to playing that side is that they're the, like, alt-history side. They're the, like, well, actually, the odds are kind of stacked against them. They become very interesting to play as. There's kind of an allure to, like, can I beat the odds here and, like, use my amazing, like, military prowess that I have to, you know, change the course of history? If you do that often enough, like, at a certain point, is there kind of a, like, subtext where, like, these games are encouraging you to identify with maybe the Germans more than you otherwise should, right? Like, you're identifying with the Germans a hell of a lot more than, like, say, you know, the Soviets, for instance. Because, you know, like, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. I play a lot of games where, you know, you're trying to see, can the Germans make Operation Barbarossa work, the invasion of the Soviet Union? Can they pull it off? Really interesting topic. It's a topic with a horror story, like, attached to it. But nevertheless, the story isn't as interesting from the other side in terms of, like, making a game out of it. Like, those early days for the Soviet Union, that is hard to make an interesting strategy game where you feel like the Soviets are an interesting protagonist in that story. Mm. And there's a lot of reasons for that, just because the arc of that campaign. But it's an odd thing, and I don't know that there's a way that a game can easily resolve that. I don't think the solution is the game has to somehow remind you at every turn, like, hey, this side is really bad, because that's patronizing. Right. In the end, people are going to fetishize these sort of signs, symbols, history of these corrupt and fascist, like, regimes. And to an extent, that's not my problem, right? Like, these people are going to do that no matter what. Like, it's this weird thing. It makes it hard for me to participate in these hobbies sometimes, because it is really alienating to enter those spaces and realize, like, wait. Like, I just want to play a fucking game about Gettysburg. And y'all are kind of really into the whole, like, you know, man, if only the South had won thing. And, like, are you just, like, kind of role-playing Robert E. Lee? Or is this kind of, like, you know, a daydream for you? Because I'm not here for that. And so that makes it complicated, but nothing that... I'm not going to give up, like, a field of interest or a hobby that I, like, really enjoy and topics that I really enjoy because people are fucking creepy about it. The best thing that I can do in that case is just try to bring my own knowledge and, you know, critical lens to bear and, like, point out these issues.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not very familiar with this game. All I know is that there would be a sense of discomfort for me in sort of taking that on. And I would be wary of the, you know, the Troy Goodfellow sort of hidden curriculum aspect, if there is one, to this. Because obviously any simulation of this nature, any game that is purporting to be a fun and interesting game is going to obviously be obfuscating some of the details of this war out of the simulation itself, right? You're not necessarily... I hope you're not participating in necessarily... acts of genocide in the game itself. You're participating in a campaign, right, on a battlefield. It's not necessarily the same thing that you're doing. You're certain parts of it are obviously
like, yeah, I mean, like, certainly. In the game, like, specifically, the game encourages you to use strategic bombing as a tool to win the war, World War II, strategic bombing is indiscriminate, like, destruction of civilian targets. That's what strategic bombing is in that era. And now the weird thing is, the game even, like, I think makes it work the way bomber commanders thought bombing worked in World War II, if that makes sense. Like, what we now know is that these air campaigns were pretty ineffective in a lot of ways. Like, bombing wasn't precise. Like, you never hit where you were aiming for. So it just wasn't a super effective way to break the enemy's capacity to wage war. But in the game, it is. And so the game is kind of being like, well, you know, you can actually really hobble someone's infrastructure if you just bomb the shit out of them. In reality, it didn't hobble them all that much. It just killed a lot of people. And after a certain point, killing people became the object of the bombing, though people hesitated to just admit it straight up. But in Hearts of Iron, it's very much this like, oh yeah, you definitely want to like strategically bomb enemy cities because that's how you like destroy their industry and their infrastructure, and it gums up the works, basically. And so the game is encouraging you, even gives you like ahistoric incentives in some ways to be like, yeah, send out research the B-29, send it out.
Right. This is almost cleaner in a way, or more effective in a way, which is, that is very interesting. All right, cool. I think that's probably going to do us for today in terms of questions. Of course, if you have questions, you can send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. As always, shout outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're on twitch.tv/Waypoint. And we're everything that we write. You can read it at waypoint.vice.com. Rob, where can we find you online?
At Rob Zachney.
Patrick, how about you?
At Patrick Klubik.
Fantastic. You can find me at Danielle R.I. Of course, if you want to. And I will always remind you during this beautiful weekend to be good and be good at it.
And live long enough to see yourself become young.
So good at phrases.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.